This is a podcast from RTE Radio.
Speaking Ill of the Dead is a series of lectures that allows historians to give vent to their animosity towards controversial figures in Irish history. The third programme of the series, recorded at the National Museum in March in front of a live audience, brings us back to the Middle Ages and to a tempestuous Irish-born cleric who almost brought Oxford University to its knees before it had become established as Britain's premier seat of learning. Professor Terry Dolan of the School of English and Drama at University College Dublin and compiler of the Hiberno-English Dictionary speaks ill of Richard Fitzrafe.
Chancellor of Oxford and later Archbishop of Armagh were very elevated appointments for a man who had modestly started life in Dundalk, County Louth, around the year 1300. At that time in his life, he was called Richard Rauf, R-A-U-F. Now, it would take a very special type of personality to be born in Dundalk, a remote backward town, and to become a star preacher, academic and ecclesiastic in Oxford, London, Paris and Avignon, to associate with the most powerful scholars and bishops of the age, let alone popes and kings, and to die at 60 years of age at the papal curia in Avignon. From there, his remains were returned 10 years later to be reburied in the Church of St. Nicholas, Dundalk, now known as the Green Church. There has been no trace of the tomb for centuries in that church, which is now ministered by the Church of Ireland. It is significant that the Anglican Church is far more devoted to Richard Fitzrafe than the Roman Catholic Church. Indeed, some people recognised him as a proto-Protestant because of his extreme views on the medieval church. So then, the Church of Ireland, Church of St. Nicholas, Dundalk, contains a chapel dedicated to this very day. I've been there several times to think about him and to pray at his tomb, or the site of the tomb, to Richard, St. Richard of Dundalk. As we shall see, some very controversial people gave him the title saint, even heretics. These people were so controversial that he was never formally canonized, because obviously popes are very wary of heretics, especially those who said the papacy was a farce, confession was a fraud, and transubstantiation was a con job. The person who said that was the person who said St. Richard Fitzrafe is one of the greatest clerics who ever lived. So you can see the kind of friends he had on his side. His saintly title, therefore, is maintained only by popular local acclaim. And we shall investigate in the next few minutes to see if this title is unmerited and unearned. When he died, he was known by the name which still serves him to this day, Richard Fitzrafe or Fitzralph. In Latin, Ricardus Fitzradulphus. And I often wonder what that name would sound like in a Dundalk Latin accent. Ricardus Fitzradulphus. This is not the way how he started life. His family name, as I said, was Rauf. The Rauf were a very modest family in Dundalk, not that well off. One of whose sons was called Richard, probably Dick, or at the time, Dicks were often called Dickon. So Dickon Rauf is how he started out. This was obviously not good enough for an ambitious young man, and so by 1325 he changed his name to Ricardus Fitzradulphus to sound more high class. He was always very stylish, always designer-driven, as we shall see. Later, some of his enemies jeered at his pretentiousness and reminded him, though he was by then Chancellor of Oxford, that his real name was not Fitzrafe, Fritz Rauf, but simply Dick Rauf, Dickon Rauf, Dickie Rauf. That's what you started out with. We knew you before you had anything. We knew you when you had nothing. Typical to this day of the people of Cavan and Dundalk. One of the richest and most powerful men in Oxford at the time was the aristocratic Richard Berry, a graduate of Merton College, who was Bishop of Durham from 1333 until his death in 1345. By today's standards, he was a multi-millionaire. He entertained lavishly and gathered around him some of the most distinguished scholars of the age, whom he liked to set disputing about various issues every day after dinner. There was no such thing as a free dinner. In they would come, and medieval meals were enormous at the time. Veal, venison, beef, cakes, ales, wine, buckets of food, buckets of drunkenness as well, as we shall see. And he'd get these young men, when they were quite fluters, as we would say, to go and talk earnestly about the freedom of the will and predestination. After a huge banquet, probably they couldn't even stand up at the time. This was entertainment in the 14th century. Now, these were most desirable soirees for young men on the make. And among this group was our own great St. Richard Fitzrafe, who had come to Oxford about 1315, just at the age of 15, all the way from Dundalk to study at Balliol College. He was very bright. He became a fellow of Balliol College and took his doctorate in theology at 1331. So he's now Dr. Fitzrafe, and as we shall see, he loves titles. Berry was not, though, his only, nor indeed his most powerful patron. He'd also got to know another very powerful, extremely wealthy bishop called John Grandison, Bishop of Exeter, from 1328 to 1369. Now, one of the ways to make money at that time was to get a benefice, an ecclesiastical living, which would furnish what we call in French a bénéfice, which means profit. It produces money. So you go out looking for benefices and you'll be all right. Grandison's father had excellent connections, and he petitioned the Pope to allow his son to possess several ecclesiastical offices, plus the funds, plus the property that went with them. This young Grandison was only 14 at the time, an early start to a rich future, and he had no qualification at all, but there he was in the possession of benefices and all kinds of ecclesiastical rights from the age of 14. At the age of 20, this man became Archdeacon of Nottingham, again without any qualifications, or if they were, they were dubious at the time. Such shameless wangling through family connections must have dazzled Fitzrafe, who only began to take a serious interest in pursuing a relationship and friendship with Grandison after he was appointed to the See of Exeter. Fitzrafe always looked out for someone who was a rising star and attached himself to that star. He had no time whatever, as we should see, for losers, people who were of no account and of no value and of no influence in society. So close did he become to this bishop and his family that he took time off from his studies in Oxford to become private tutor to Bishop Grandison's nephew, John Northwood. He took this young man to study at the Sorbonne in Paris. Things were going very well for him, as you can see at this time. But he recognised always he'd been in Avignon, not yet, but he'd been to Oxford, but he thought Avignon was the place to go. That was where it was the seat of the Roman Curia since the reign of Pope Clement V, who died in 1314. Now, for a young, ambitious ecclesiastic, it was essential to be acknowledged by the Pope himself. Besides, Fitzrafe liked being around big players, so much so that he spent a total of 13 years there in the course of this and three other visits. Remember, he died at 60, but for 13 of those years, he wasn't where he should have been. He was in Avignon, around the Pope and the bishops. Fitzrafe certainly had a powerful friend in Grandison, who in May 1331 generously gave his Irish friend a salary and promised to get him a benefice. Grandison knew the importance of having a regular source of income, since he, as we'd seen, had benefices from the time of 14 years of age. About this time, too, Grandison sought permission from John the 22nd to make Fitzrafe a canon. So we had Dr. Fitzrafe, now we have Canon Fitzrafe. But greater things were to come. He had not abandoned his connections with Oxford, and so at the age of 32, or thereabouts, he was elected Chancellor of Oxford, a truly spectacular rise to fame and power. You start in Dundalk, and 32 years later, you are Chancellor of the most famous university then known on the planet. It's an extraordinary rise. What kind of personality does that? Things didn't go well there, though, and this is again part of the personality problem. From all accounts, the former Richard Fitzroffe had a very mercurial, irascible personality, rather like his hero. His hero was Thomas Becket, whom you know was a great friend and then a great enemy of Henry II. And he based his life, as far as he could, on that of Thomas Becket. Fitzrafe's first sermon to an Avignon audience in 1335 was, in fact, on St. Thomas of Canterbury, saying what a wonderful person he was and how, by, I suppose, hinting, Fitzrafe was the next Thomas Becket. During his period in office as Chancellor, a number of masters and students decamped from Oxford to the Lincolnshire town of Stamford, in a move which became notorious as the Stamford Schism. It could have happened at this time that we would not be talking about Oxford today at all. We'd be talking about Stamford and Cambridge, not Oxford and Cambridge. And this is all possibly to do with what our friend Richard was doing in Oxford as Chancellor. We've come to think now of the major English universities as Oxford and Cambridge, but their eminence only became fixed in the 14th century. Other towns had what we might call third-level institutions, and these were called studia. Stamford had one of these. Now, Oxford at the time was an extremely violent place. Students regularly got drunk and fought on the streets as in modern-day Paris. A major cause of the rioting was feuding between northern and southern students, and the northerners decided to withdraw. It's interesting to speculate, though, of why this withdrawal to Stamford should take place during Fitzrafe's watch. Rather like Dominic de Villepin in Paris, he was authoritarian and inflexible with the students, and this was unwise in view of the delicacy of the situation. Rather than pacifying the students, he made things worse by his high-handed, aristocratic treatment of them. He was clearly very annoyed by what had happened. In that hot-headed way of his, he wagered his head that the secession would be over in just 6 months. It wasn't. It lasted nearly 3 years. Now, thanks to the king's intervention, the schism ended in 1335 and Stamford was suppressed. It doesn't seem to have done Fitzrafe much harm, though, because it was felt that he had possibly exacerbated the situation so much that the king had to intervene and disabuse unhappy Oxford students of the possibility of decamping and setting up elsewhere. In other words, he brought matters to a head, which politically for Oxford was a very good thing. It's now Oxford and Cambridge, not Stamford and Cambridge. After his term of office as Chancellor came to an end, he needed a job. It seems that Grandison and another great figure, Thomas Bradwardine, later Archbishop of Canterbury, helped to make him Dean of Lichfield in 1335. He held this post for about 10 years, though he spent the most of the time back in Avignon as an absentee. So he wasn't there. He should have been in Lichfield. Where was he? He was away in Avignon. Brown nosing, as we might say to this day. Even to this day, as you'll admit, the area around Cavan and Louth is famous for the tight-fistedness of the locals. Then, too, Fitzrafe, a Louth man, was also mean, extremely mean and tight in the matter of hospitality to his fellow clerics at Lichfield. He insisted that he was obliged to entertain them only on two occasions in the year, according to the letter, not to the spirit of the law, on the feast of the patron saint of the diocese, St. Chad, and on the feast of the Assumption. He got the cathedral chapter to make a formal agreement to this effect. Now, such meanness was insensitive, and it also disclosed another feature of his personality. He was a literalist, and he was extremely litigious. He was always going to the law, almost like a modern American. It seems that he was not so literal about his own obligations over diocesan funds. For no good reason, he sacked the dean's proctor, the curia, the person who acted on their behalf, and the deans gave Fitzrafe the money to take to Avignon to pay this man, Robert de Thresk, the son he was owed. Thresk later wrote to the canons complaining that he had not been paid. In other words, what happened to the money? Fitzrafe had pocketed the money and run off with it for whatever in Avignon. He might not have been generous to his fellow ecclesiastics who had to run the cathedral while he was away, but he was very generous to his three nephews. He facilitated their paths to study in Oxford and arranged appointments for them in Avignon, Ossory, and Dublin. The Latin word nepos means nephew, and this, I suggest, is a classic case of nepotism on Fitzray's part, hypocrisy too. He was obsessively conscious of his dignity and status and carefully designated himself by his official titles right the way up to when he was proudly able to call himself Ricardus Radulfi Archiepiscopus Almacanus Hibernia Primas, Richard Fitzrafe, Archbishop of Armagh. He is very concerned, too, about the symbols of his office, particularly in the matter of his primatial cross, the cross which symbolised his status as head of the church in Ireland. He insisted that his cross should be carried before him, not just his own diocese of Armagh, but also in that in Dublin, where the archbishops jealously guarded their sole right to have their primatial crosses borne before them. One of his visits to Avignon, early in his tenure of the Archbishopric of Armagh, he asked the Pope to give him the right to have his cross carried before him wherever he was in Ireland. Think of all the other things happening in Avignon, and there is our Richard say, I want my cross to be born before me. Now, Armagh was a desperately poor, dysfunctional diocese which needed its leader to be there all the time. Fitzrafe, though, seemed to be more troubled by the trappings of his office than by his duties as pastor. It was left to no less a person than King Richard III to tell Fitzrafe to go back home to Ireland and look after his own people, to look after his diocese. To be fair, though, to Fitzrafe, the issue over which diocese has primacy, Armagh or Dublin, was quite a long-running one. A predecessor, Archbishop Yours of Armagh in 1313, tried to have his cross carried before him when he came to Dublin to attend a parliament, but some members of the staff of the Archbishop of Dublin, John Leck, sallied forth and violently disrupted the Archbishop's procession, and the Archbishop put away his cross. But Fitzrafe himself was not a wilting flower, so when he came, it was decided on the compromise of having Dublin as the primatial see of Ireland and Armagh the primatial see of all Ireland. He got so heated over the issue, he excommunicated all those who opposed his primacy. Such shenanigans began to annoy Edward III so much, who'd hoped that the new archbishop would be active in bringing peace to Ireland and harmony between the natives and settlers, but Fitzrafe had his own priorities, especially his dignity. He manipulated facts to suit his own agenda. One of his most important arguments against the friars concerned the rule of absolute poverty, paupitas as absoluta. He arraigned all friars for their deception and deviance from this rule of life, conveniently choosing to ignore the fact that only one mendicant order, the Franciscans, were committed to practicing absolute poverty. The Augustinians, Carmelites, and Dominicans were not bound by this rule. Such was his determination to rid the church of friars that he used every rhetorical means, true or false, to denigrate his opponents. Ungratefully and ungraciously, he was particularly enraged at the Franciscans, the order whose close familiarity he had enjoyed as a child, since they were the only religious order in the town of Dundalk. They educated him, a fact he warmly acknowledged in one sermon in 1349. Here, too, he noted that some members of his own family had joined the order. As we say now, eaten bread is soon forgotten. The high point of Fitzrafe's final trip to Avignon took place on Wednesday the 8th, 1357. On that day, he delivered his most famous diatribe against the friars, especially the Franciscans, the order which he had spent the last 10 years excoriating for their venality, delinquency, and hypocrisy. It was a tour de force. On this momentous occasion, the Pope was there and the Curia of Cardinals, at that time just about 20, much fewer than today. This speech survives in over 70 manuscripts. After the invention of printing, it was published many times, it was translated into English, and the notorious hater of Catholics, John Fox, summarised it with copious annotations in his famous and infamous Book of Martyrs, published in England in English in 1563. In this address, he seeks to demonstrate that the friars, though ordained, do not have the same rights of ministry as secular priests. He's particularly vexed at the way friars administer confession. They give light penitence, he alleges, in order to attract gifts from wealthy, naive parishioners who may later consider burying their loved ones in cemeteries attached to friaries rather than in the parish graveyards, a great loss of income to the parish clergy. Fitzrafe's main authority for his denial of the rights of friars to hear confession is a document which issued from the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215. And Canon 21 of that document says and begins, "Let everyone of either sex, omnis utriusque sexus, go to confession to their own parish priest at least once a year, and then Easter or thereabouts." In other words, the Easter duty. Fitzrafe said that the friars were not priests at all, in the accepted sense of the word, and the friars were furious at his interpretation of this. But they did fight back, and a friar called Richard Helmsley in 1360 said, if you think of the beginning of that statute, Canon 21, it said, let everybody of either sex, utriusque sexus, meaning it's dealing only with hermaphrodites or bisexuals, and ordinary people of the clergy and the rest needn't bother to go to confession at all because it's only hermaphrodites and bisexuals. Nobody else need to go to confession. He's especially exercised about the way that the friars claim to be living a life of absolute poverty based on the life of Christ and the apostles. Apart from the fact that, according to him, the friars hypocritically live rich, consumerist lives, there's also a theological objection to poverty. Fitzrafe denies that Christ lived in this way because poverty is bad, and Christ would not espouse badness. This leads him to make the outrageous claim that poverty is an effect of sin. If you are poor, he says, it's because you've been sinful, you've committed some dreadful act. Therefore, you deserve to be poor. You should work for your possessions. And he likes the Old Testament proverb, "The poor man shall be hateful even to his neighbour." Nobody wants the poor. The poor are lazy and they should go out to work or they should starve. He was a Thatcherite. Fitzrafe is not above making allegations about friars and women too, especially queens and socialites, above all beautiful ones. He inveigles the Pope and the rest of the audience into imagining what the friars and the ladies confessing to them got up to in their private chambers, and then says, "But I won't go into this any further." There was no such thing at that time as a confessional box. The confessional box was not invented till 1564. It was invented in the Diocese of Milan to stop priests groping the penitents. That's the reason. And so this time, Fitzrafe, drawing attention to the dangers of confession, was absolutely right, but it was reckless at the same time, because he was talking about the confessors of the queens. Fitzrafe uses scripture to back up his negative views on mendicancy. Sometimes he forces a quotation into a most unlikely interpretation. For instance, "Lead us not into temptation," he says, means don't become a friar, because which means all mendicant friars are tempters, and being a friar is a temptation. Therefore, lead us not into temptation. He ends his address with the biblical quotation on which it is based, and which he inserts throughout its core: "Judge not according to the appearance, but judge just judgment." I think this sums up the major flaw in his personality and approach. He is judgmental about what the friars appears to be doing. He's always looking at what they appear to be doing, what they are doing, and he invents all the time. Fitzrafe died in 1360. After his death, the words still resonated and had remarkable effects, sometimes perhaps disastrously, which is where I'm going to finish. The longest portrait in the general prologue to Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is that of the friar who is described as associating with the rich, especially rich women, despising the poor, giving easy penances, and so forth. All these assertions have been made by Richard Fitzrafe some 30 years before. It is a conjecture on my part. The Archbishop had been a celebrated preacher in London, Chaucer's hometown, for a number of years. He delivered a number of sermons against the friars at various locations in the city, especially at St. Paul's Cross in London when Chaucer was about 16. The young poet might have been there to hear it. One intended consequence of Fitzrafe's and Chaucer's anti-mendicacy should be mentioned. So a few years ago, one of the Monty Pythons, Terry Jones and myself, co-wrote with some others a book entitled Who Murdered Chaucer? And I just want to finish on this. Chaucer's death is recorded on a tomb in Westminster Abbey as the 25th of October 1400. This is probably wrong because the tomb itself dates from 1556 1.5 centuries after the event took place. So what happened to Geoffrey Chaucer? After the assassination of Richard II, the new king, Henry IV, who had usurped the throne from the rightful King Richard, a major patron of Chaucer's, began a series of witch hunts against supporters of the old regime. Henry and his chief henchman, the sinister Archbishop Arundel of Canterbury, needed pretexts. What better than to examine alleged miscreants for anti-ecclesiastical remarks? The friars were very powerful, as I said, confessors to kings and queens. It follows that criticism of the friars could be interpreted as criticism of the spiritual advisers to the monarchy. If Chaucer were murdered, a factor in this process which resulted in his sudden death could have been the anti-mendicant sentiments he voiced throughout his poetry, which the huge prestige of Fitzrave had helped to authenticate and disseminate during his youth. Chaucer had not expected to die at that time because we've discovered he took out, as one of his last recorded acts, a huge new tenancy on his dwelling just before he died. With all the bad things, one good thing that Fitzrave may be associated with concerns President Nixon. In his developing attack on the friars, Fitzrave devised an explosive theory which has come to be known as the theory of dominion and grace. It means that if you are in an important, responsible office and you are held to be delinquent by your peers, you can be removed from that office, in other words, impeachment. It goes back to Fitzrave. St. Richard is a saint only in his native Dundalk. Plans to make him a cardinal and to canonise him all failed. He became too associated in people's minds with the forces that resulted in the Reformation. The heretic Wycliffe, founder of the Lollards, the man who said the Pope was a fraud and the rest, frequently called him a saint and espoused his theory of dominion and grace. A pathetic little couplet devised, I think, in Dunork, said, "Many a man I see and many a mile I walk, but never saw I holier man than Richard of Dundalk." So then, to finish, born in a remote town in a poverty-stricken, strife-torn diocese, educated by Franciscans, whom he later turned on with ferocious ferocity, he sought out important patrons in England who added and aided his sensational rise to fame and power. By nature mercurial and energetic, he lectured and preached in Ireland, England, and France. He died in Avignon, having lost a major case against the mendicant friars. He was made a saint by local popular acclamation. Fitzrave consorted with the rich, criticised the poor for being poor, got jobs for his family, upset King Edward III, infuriated the scholars of Oxford, led the international campaign against the friars, later taken up by Chaucer in the Canterbury Tales. Famously vain, headstrong, opportunistic, venal, hypercritical, and unpredictable, Richard Rorke of Dundalk, Dean, Chancellor, and Archbishop, merits our admiration for virtually everything but holiness.
Professor Terry Dolan of the School of English and Drama at UCD on Richard Fitzrafe, turbulent medieval cleric. Next week, Senator David Norris on one of his least favourite Irish historical figures, Sean McBride.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie.